Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 9th of September. So here's how today's show came about. We were reading the current issue of Mental Floss magazine. We've done some shows on their articles in the past. And this caught our attention, seven tiny books that packed a big punch. Number one on their list is Common Sense by Thomas Paine. And it got us immediately thinking about Harvey Kay, who had been a guest on our show when he wrote this wonderful book about Thomas Paine and the Promise of America is the name of the book. So we thought, well, let's talk to him again about Thomas Paine, because he's always worth talking about. The Mental Floss article says this: in the 1970s, American colonists were riding the fence. Should they cut ties with the tax-happy King George or just sit around drinking English tea? As they waffled, a penniless Brit named Thomas Paine sailed to Philadelphia and published the incendiary tract Common Sense. And it goes on to talk about common sense and how phenomenally important it was to the American Revolution, how many copies it sold, etc. Harvey loves Thomas Paine and has Thomas Paine's books right on his nightstand. So that's an indication of how much he really likes Thomas Paine. And he teaches him, and he has studied Thomas Paine. He's Rosenberg Professor of History and Sociology and Director of the Center for History and Social Change at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He teaches historical perspectives on social change, history, politics, and criticism, plus intro to sociology. He's written many books, including Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, The British Marxist Historians, The Powers of the Past, The Education of Desire, Why Do Ruling Classes Fear History, and Other Questions, Thomas Paine, Firebrand of the Revolution, which is a young adult biography, and many other books. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and if you would like to send an email, you can do that. That is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Harvey Kay, thank you for joining us again. I'm looking forward to the hour. Thanks. Hello, Harvey, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Kathleen.
Okay.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm feeling great.
Good, good. Glad to have you here. You've written so beautifully about Thomas Paine. Tell me why you took him to heart. It had to do with your grandparents, didn't it?
Right. When I was no more than 10 years old, I grew up in the New Jersey, New York area, and my grandparents lived in Brooklyn, New York. And whenever we would go to their home, which was opposite the Brooklyn Museum, this really fine art and history museum, it would often be the case that there were times when my grandparents would want to talk to my parents or somebody else, and they really didn't want me in the room, and they would often talk in Yiddish to, as many foreign speakers do, to let kids know we don't want you to understand. And it was at those times that I would try to find, if there was a cousin there, an older one, to take me across to the museum. And if there was no cousin, I would wander their apartment as if it was something of a museum, and every room was its own gallery. And I would always end up in the back of what I still can see as their dining room, where my grandfather kept a personal collection of his books. He was a trial lawyer, and so he had an office in New York City itself where all his legal books were. But this was an area where he kept the books that he enjoyed or that he found educational. And there was one little section, when I would sit down on the floor looking at these books, of books by and about Thomas Paine. And the one that really caught my attention, I think because it had a red, white, and blue cover, was a book that I now know to be utterly ridiculous. But nevertheless, it argued that Thomas Paine was the real author of the Declaration of Independence. And the reason I particularly enjoyed it is it showed that all my teachers were wrong.
Ah.
And I mean, that was kind of exciting for a 10-year-old.
Right.
But I really didn't understand much that was in the book. But I kind of adopted Paine, and my grandfather, I think, encouraged it, and a few years later sort of handed to me the other books. So when I was growing up, I read as much as I could by Thomas Paine, even if I didn't understand it all, although he's very readable. I mean, when I keep stuff by my bedside that's by Thomas Paine, I tell everyone, if you want to read somebody from the 18th century who not only shaped American history tremendously but is still understandable today, read Paine, especially read Common Sense. So it's my grandfather who really sort of kicked it off in me, and I made him my childhood hero, although I never got around to doing any kind of scholarly or, you know, public writing on him until the 1990s.
Tell me specifically about Common Sense. It's not that big a book. Mental Floss talking about a tiny book that packed a big punch. This was an extraordinarily influential book, wasn't it?
Really extraordinary. You have to start off with the fact that he had only arrived in America a year before he was going to write this pamphlet. That he didn't know, but that he would write this pamphlet. And in the course of that year, he just fell in love with America. He had been he came away from England angry and disappointed. He was already almost 40 years old, and he had had a very mixed career of activities as a working man, as an excise officer, tax collector, essentially. I mean, he had had a very, very unsettling sort of young adulthood. And he arrived in America in this almost middle-aged time in his life, and he fell in love with what he discovered having arrived in Philadelphia. It was utterly unlike anything that he remembered about England. It was a small city with a lot of activity. Americans were already agitated and organizing to defend themselves against British impositions. And he found himself, strangely enough, offered a job as an editor of a magazine. A magazine that was just starting up, and he ended up turning it into probably the most popular magazine in the American colonies at the time. And along the way, he became all the more impressed by Americans and all the more outraged by the kinds of things Britain was doing to the colonies to impose its will. And what really put him over the top on this question, or over the edge on this question, was Lexington and Concord. And after that, he became all the more committed to what people thought of as the American cause. The only thing was that nobody really knew what the American cause was. I mean, was it a matter of negotiating the taxes? Was it a matter of renegotiating the colonial relationship? Nobody really knew. Even the firebrands of that time, like Samuel Adams and others, really never talked about independence. But Paine, the more he talked to people and the more he thought about it, developed this idea that what Americans really needed to do was to understand that they weren't British subjects. They didn't owe anything to the king. They gained nothing from the empire. And so he argued that what Americans needed to do was think of themselves as Americans, and in those terms declare themselves independent. Now, but the punch really was, you know, everyone thinks about it like that, and it's often presented that way in the schools. But I think the real punch, and I haven't seen the Mental Floss article, so I'm going to go out and get a copy. But the real punch was the fact not just that he called for independence, but he called for independence and the making of an American democratic republic. That was a really radical idea. But in doing so, he essentially expresses, the best word is articulates, what's going on in the hearts and minds of many Americans, but things that they themselves have yet to speak of. Mm-hmm. For example, there were those who were sort of the Baptists, the Presbyterians, the Methodists, whose numbers were smaller than that, but there were these sort of nonconformist Protestants who were really, really upset with the fact that Congregationalists dominated politics and ruled in New England, and Anglicans ruled in the South. And they really did believe, when they read Common Sense, as Thomas Paine argued, that the only role for government in religion is to protect everyone's right to practice it in their own way. So in other words, Paine's first appeal to many people really had something to do with the idea of religious freedom, or what we would today call in America separation of church and state. He also talked about the advantages of American independence commercially. And every single point possible, he argues as to why Americans should declare their independence to enable themselves to become what they really do want to become, but they haven't really talked about openly. And it resonates with this incredible democratic spirit. He never uses the word democracy throughout the pamphlet. The word democracy never appears. But everyone knew when they finished reading it what Paine was calling for and what they should go out and fight for.
So what did the other people who we think of first when we think of the Founding Fathers think of Thomas Paine? Did they think he was a radical, that he wasn't elite, or what?
You think about the colonial radicals or rebels of their day, the ones who become our sort of Founding Fathers as heroes, you know, the heroic Founding Fathers, you know, you think of Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, and to some extent, I think even John Adams still, you know, is in many people's minds that way, especially after McCullough's book. These folks, when they came to know who had written the pamphlet, they loved the pamphlet. Oh, they absolutely loved it. Well, at least Thomas Jefferson loved the pamphlet. Washington loved the pamphlet. Adams had some mixed feelings about it because Adams wasn't as keen on the democratic idea as Paine was. Adams thought independence was a great idea, but he was very disturbed by the idea that the people might actually rule in an independent America.
Right.
So in any case, when they actually discovered who had written it, they also probably had some mixed feelings there because this was a guy they figured out who had been, he came out of essentially a working class, an artisan family. I mean, Paine's father had been a corset maker, and Paine had trained as a corset maker. This was not a college-educated preacher, a lawyer, landowner, merchant. This was a guy who came, who really did, when he sought to speak for the people, he could do so because he was one of the people. So in one sense, they were really rather disturbed. On the other hand, some of them really liked him. They liked him because of the spirit that he exuded. And also, they figured out that this was a guy whose pen, literally his pen, could be very effective in the American cause. So that even John Adams, who had very mixed feelings about Paine, went out of his way to recruit Paine, not only to benefit from his arguments and common sense, but also to continue writing on behalf of the American Revolutionary cause, as did George Washington. And thus we eventually end up as well with The Crisis, which is this, you know, the famous pamphlet where Paine writes, "These are the times that try men's souls." Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, there were some, and now I'll get to some of the others. Adams increasingly came to dislike Paine because he figured Paine really was a revolutionary and a little too much of a democratic revolutionary. And then you get the likes of a guy named Gouverneur Morris, who was a New York merchant and lawyer, a very prominent figure at the time, and eventually becomes a very prominent figure at the Constitutional Convention. He did not like Thomas Paine at all, and especially because Paine's very presence in the revolutionary movement threatened the most powerful and the most wealthy figures whose ambitions for America was to create, as Paine's ambitions were, to create a strong nation state. But their idea was to have a strong nation state in which inequality was never challenged, in which freedom meant freedom to make a lot of money in commerce. And Paine's idea of America was essentially a land where working people would be equal participants in governing this country. So there was really mixed feelings about Paine from the beginning, although the people loved him, absolutely loved Thomas.
Yeah. So, and you needed those people. You needed they embraced, I'm sure, the common people, the second part of that, where everybody could function, you know, this idea of equality. You had to have people to fight the revolution, so they needed Paine.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, it's funny, if we could go back in time and hang out in the pubs and the taverns and the coffee houses, we would find that whenever the revolution was toasted, it was often, you know, a toast to the American cause, a toast to Washington, and a toast to common sense. And when they toasted common sense, they didn't just mean the arguments of the pamphlet. They meant Mr. Common Sense, meaning Thomas Paine. This goes on for years. They just love Thomas Paine. And every quarter, even, you know, it's interesting, even the Congregationalists, who were disturbed by that kind of religious democratic spirit that the Presbyterians and the Baptists and others were developing, even they loved common sense because Paine did have arguments in the pamphlet that referred in some ways perhaps to what God intended Americans to do. You know, Paine said, you know, he says, it's not a coincidence, basically, you know, that at the time of the Reformation, America becomes available to Protestants as a place to take refuge. It really does raise some. I mean, you know, it's hard to believe that a guy who grew up working class,
yes,
had so much brilliance. I mean, so much brilliance that, you know, who knew that even 5 years after my book appeared, I still feel this excited about
it. I can tell you. It's why we love talking to you.
I just go crazy talking about Thomas Paine.
I know.
Some people say, well, is there anything wrong with the guy that you can think of, you know? And I'd rather not think about it. But, yeah, I mean, we could find flaws with everyone, of course.
Let's go to phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Professor Harvey Kay is our guest, Rosenberg Professor of History and Sociology and Director of the Center for History and Social Change at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. He's the author of a number of books pertinent to our conversation, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. Our lines are all filled, but there will be there'll be openings as we go along, and you can also send us emails. Let's start with Mike from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I'm wondering if you can give a quick critique on Glenn Beck's writings on Thomas Paine. And it just seems to me what information I've been able to gather about it, it doesn't seem to reflect any of the ideas that Thomas Paine had talked about. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, especially last year, I guess about 18 months ago, Glenn Beck decided he was going to channel Thomas Paine, you know, in the spiritualist sense.
Oh, my goodness.
Which, by the way, is kind of funny, because in the 19th century, when the spiritualists were plentiful in America, the most popular figure that they channeled was Thomas Paine from the hereafter.
Oh, my goodness, really?
And so all of a sudden, Glenn Beck decides he's going to channel Thomas Paine, and he writes a pamphlet. Glenn Beck actually writes a little booklet, a pamphlet, titled, like, Thomas Paine's Common Sense as, you know, told by Glenn Beck. And the book actually became, I think for a while, the number one bestseller on the paperback list. And he actually had a one-man show, Beck, that he took on the road. And talk about showman, he took this show on the road in the very week that was the 200th anniversary of Thomas Paine's death.
Uh-huh.
Now, having said all of that, there is, if one reads Beck, it is the caller is right. It was Mike. Mike is right. It is very hard to find any connection between the arguments of Glenn Beck and the arguments of Thomas Paine. So one asks himself, well, how does it do this? How does it get away with it? Why would he go to Thomas Paine? And here's my answer, and it's kind of twofold. The first thing is that Beck and many conservatives, ever since Reagan, realized, I think even much more effectively than liberals, that Thomas Paine's, even if his name and the details of his life aren't always there, Thomas Paine's arguments stayed with Americans all the way through the generations. So in essence, to resurrect Paine's name and try to wrap your arms around it is in some ways to lay claim to the very best of the American revolutionary tradition, the American founding moment. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, and that comes directly from that, is the likes of Beck they're noisemakers. Basically, they're the ones who sort of, you know, rouse people who are already perhaps inclined to a kind of conservative politics. They rouse them and harness their anger. And if you're going to try to rouse people, who better than to refer to than Thomas Paine? So I think in some ways there's that element. Now, there's a third element to it, which may give them more credit than they deserve, those like Glenn Beck and others, who are on the political right and have nothing to do with Thomas Paine's legacy. I think in some ways it has to do with the fact that they just want to irk the political left. You know, it's like,
that's interesting.
What better thing to do than to try to rip off, to appropriate the heroes of liberals and people of the left? What can you do better than to steal their usual heroes? I mean, the person who really represents the model of doing that was Ronald Reagan. In 1980, at the Republican National Convention, Ronald Reagan, first of all, I think he unsettled people. I know he really annoyed George Will, the conservative columnist, by doing it. Ronald Reagan's two foremost references in his acceptance speech in 1980 were to Thomas Paine, which shocked people. Conservatives were never supposed to talk favorably of Paine. And then to Franklin Roosevelt,
right.
Who, by the way, was the first president after Thomas Jefferson to not only quote from Thomas Paine, but to actually talk favorably about him in his speeches. So, I mean, Reagan was, in his own way, politically brilliant. And I think that, I Glenn Beck is no fool, okay? And I think in some ways he was trying to pick up on what Reagan himself did back then. So, again, I see very little connection between Beck's politics. Although, to be fair, because you're liable to get some libertarians to call in, and I want to be fair and tell you that early in Common Sense, there is an argument made by Payne that if left just with the few lines Payne's offers, can seem to be something that libertarians and anarchists would make their slogans, their mottos, is, you know, government is a necessary evil.
Right.
And both libertarians and anarchists, libertarians on the right and anarchists on the left, love Thomas Paine because they see him as the first of the great modern libertarians or anarchists. But the thing to remember, which neither especially libertarians, you know, put second place to individualism and liberty, is that Paine was writing as a radical Democrat, small d Democrat. He was writing in that way to attack feudal government and to attack aristocratic government and attack kingly government. What Paine had in mind was the creation of an unprecedented democratic government.
We're going to welcome more phone calls for you in just a moment. We're talking about Thomas Paine this hour, our conversation prompted by a recent article in Mental Floss, 7 tiny books that packed a big punch. Common Sense, 52 pages, written by Thomas Paine, was number one on the list. It got us thinking about Thomas Paine. It then got us thinking about Harvey Kay, who was our guest a while ago, talking about Thomas Paine with incredible enthusiasm, we might add. And he's doing it again. He's Rosenberg Professor of History and Sociology and Director of the Center for History and Social Change at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. He is author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. He's also written a book about Thomas Paine for young adults, Paine, Firebrand of the Revolution. Thanks very much, Mike, for your call. More calls in a moment. Emails welcome to talk@wpr.org, 800-486-8655, the phone number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to more phone calls now. Richard in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Richard.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm similarly enthusiastic about Thomas Paine, but I recognize that he, during his time, was considered in many quarters to be vile, and they hated, and people hated him. And I think that the aristocratic point of view is perhaps the source of that. And for that reason, I have a rather darker view of American attitudes toward the revolution, and I don't buy all of this democracy stuff. We were selling people into slavery, both in indigenous peoples as well as black people, since the 1600s. And I'm wondering about King George's order of 1768, where he drew a north-south line down the Appalachians and criticized the European colonists for their treatment of indigenous peoples, and said, look, beyond that line to the west you shall not go, and this is the limit of the various colonies, whether they're private corporations or crown colonies, and in that sense put some kind of level of protection upon the indigenous peoples, and consequently incurred the wrath of the English and European settlers. I'd like to know what the author thinks of that point
okay.
of view.
Okay, Harvey.
Okay, well, okay, I'm. Let me try to take up these a couple of points that the caller makes, which I think are really well made. First of all, on the question of slavery, let me just say that Paine didn't necessarily have the kind of impact immediately that he would want. I mean, clearly Americans did declare the revolution. That's a consequence of his pamphlet. And they did build into, you might say, or inscribe into America's founding documents the ideal of a more egalitarian and democratic republic. I mean, Jefferson did write, all men are created equal, and all men are entitled to the pursuit of life, liberty, and so on, and, you know, happiness. Paine himself was frustrated by the fact of, in fact, not just frustrated, he was outraged at slavery. Well before Paine spoke ever of independence when he came to what would become the United States, he actually wrote against slavery. His very first important writing in America was African Slavery in America. And Paine argued for abolition. He said, how can Americans who declare for themselves for liberty, who decry British tyranny, and how could they possibly put up with their own practices of slavery and the slave trade? And so he immediately challenged Americans to bring an end to slavery, and to his credit, long before other American abolitionists did so, because many of them were prepared to put Africans back on boats and send them to colonize Africa itself, he argued in favor of the obligations that whites had towards African Americans who had been enslaved. He talked about providing education. He talked about providing land in the West. Okay, I mean, this is a man who believed that Americans themselves were capable of doing that. And although, indeed, they did not, let's not forget as well that American history is about the struggle in pursuit of the ideals of the Revolution.
How are those ideas received, Harvey?
Well, his argument, actually, it's interesting. His argument against slavery is what brought him to the attention of the members of the Continental Congress, those who themselves were from the North and had abolitionist sentiments. Benjamin Rush, the doctor in Philadelphia, immediately reached out to Thomas Paine, didn't know at first who had written it, and met with Thomas Paine. In fact, it was Benjamin Rush who supposedly persuaded Paine to write about independence. Now, the other thing I want to mention is the question about basically the relations between Anglo-Americans and First Peoples, Native Americans, Indians. Paine himself had a great admiration for American Indians and mentions this in a number of his writings, is very disturbed by the fact that that too many whites view disdainfully their Native American, in quotes, brothers. But it's also the case that Paine knew, and he knew very well, that the relations were fraught with difficulties. And I can't help but confess that one of Paine's arguments about giving land to African Americans included giving them lands along the Appalachian stretch, with the idea that they would help defend the colonies themselves or the new states themselves. But it's also the case that in between the writing of Common Sense and the Declaration of Independence, Paine writes four letters that appeared at the time, though he didn't have his name on them. And one of the letters actually argues for recognition of Native American land rights. So, I mean, admittedly, that's one voice. Now, why did Paine become so hated, as the caller remarks? Well, not so hated by everyone, but so hated by particular interests. Yes, aristocratic. People who have aristocratic ambitions would never have liked Thomas Paine to begin with. The other thing was, Southern slaveholders despised Paine because they knew he wrote against slavery. And so it begins that these sort of very rich, very powerful figures, they view Thomas Paine as a real, and his arguments as a real threat to the kind of countryside or country that they want. It's also the case that later in life, Paine is a deist. That is, he believes in God, but he denies that God reveals himself in Scripture, or herself in Scripture, if you want to use a 21st century version. Paine is not an atheist, he's a deist. But deism was a threat to the established churches. And so the Congregationalists, the Presbyterians, the major churches accused Paine basically of being, you know, not just a subversive and a heretic, practically being the Antichrist.
Right. But
So that comes into play. And, you know, there was one other thing, if I could just remember. You know, I want to come back to this idea of hated. And because it's possible some other caller is going to ask about, well, you know, what happened to all those generations where Paine is forgotten? What's interesting is Americans in the majority actually never do forget Thomas Paine, and they never actually turn against him in memory. It's those who become, you know, powerful in property, the prestigious types. They're the ones who try to suppress Paine's memory. And to respond to the caller's remarks, they actually repeat the libels against Paine, that he was an alcoholic, that he beat his first wife to death, who actually died in childbirth. I mean, they scorned him, and they accused him of the worst and vilest kinds of things. But, you know, all the way through American history, there were those in every generation, the abolitionists, the women's rights activists and suffragists, the working men's parties and later the socialists, progressives, populists here in the Midwest, they all redeem Paine's memory, and they make him one of their heroes because they want to lay claim to the tradition of the American Revolution. And it even goes on today. It even goes on today. Down in Florida, there's a group that contacted me several years ago to come and speak called Florida Veterans for Common Sense. And these are veterans from World War II all the way through to Iraq and Afghanistan, mostly Vietnam era, mostly my generation, who laid claim to Thomas Paine in order to basically challenge the Bush administration's policies on everything from war to security questions and you know, the abrogation of American rights. So there are these folks who've never abandoned Paine's memory, and in fact, I think we should make note of it. Sorry, am I going on too long?
No, it's fine. I like your enthusiasm.
The other thing I was going to say is that presidents after Roosevelt did not necessarily pick up on quoting Thomas Paine a lot, okay? But more and more Americans did, and he becomes all the more celebrated in America. And the sad thing is, and this may say more about Obama than anything, is that Barack Obama quoted Thomas Paine in his inaugural address, but he didn't cite Paine's name. And I remember when I heard the speech, and I was really, you know, I was really sort of excited that I was hearing Paine's words coming from Barack Obama, but I then thought, uh-oh, you know, what does this say about Obama that he's going to quote Paine but not use his name? I mean, Paine's there. He's there all the time. And for those of us who believe in what Paine was about, it's important for us to push that memory and push it in a favorable way.
Let's go to more phone calls. We're talking about Thomas Paine, in case you haven't determined that this hour of the program. Frank is next from Madison. Hello, Frank.
Hello. Hi. This is quite fine. A fine guest and a great topic, one of the sort of unrecognized fathers of the nation. But could I, correctly or not, I'm not sure of this, point out that you can think of Tom Paine as being a true-born Englishman and being part of an anti-establishment tradition, English, British tradition, that goes back to the English Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And he is perhaps representative of the Jacobin tendency in Britain, and very radical, as you point out. And so he wasn't quite acceptable in Britain, except in what we would now say far-left circles. And he was ultimately not acceptable in another revolution in France, and certainly far more radical than the writers of the Constitution of the United States, which is a conservative document relative to the Declaration of Independence, which raises certain expectations that America may never have actually lived up to. So thank you very much, but true-born Englishman. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
That was great. Okay. In fact, if I can just say, these are the kinds of things that I point out in the book Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. But now let me just add some stories to what your caller rightly points out. There's no doubt that Paine brings with him a kind of radical English tradition to America. Though I should also point out that even the founders like Jefferson and Adams and the others carried that same kind of English tradition themselves. Okay. Now, it's interesting that Thomas Paine's father, the corset maker, who really trained Paine to become a corset maker himself, his father was a Quaker. Now, we tend to think of Quakers as pacifists, because they are indeed pacifists. But once upon a time, Quakers were not pacifists, necessarily. And back in the 17th century, during the English Revolution and English Civil War, Quakers were quite active in those struggles. And one can readily imagine that when Paine's father is teaching his son how to work with whalebone and how to make corsets, the stay makers, you can say, that he probably also spoke to his son about the Quaker story and the Quaker tradition. And it's not unlikely that Paine heard about dissent and rebellion even as he was learning to make corsets that were holding women in tightly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a sort of irony, if you like. And so, in essence, when we think about it, I mean, yeah, the call is right. Frank is right. There is that kind of true-born Englishman about Paine. However, what really turns Paine into a radical, into a revolutionary, is his encounter with America. And that's very, very clear. In other words, what is at first a kind of radical set of instincts becomes a revolutionary democratic spirit because of what Paine sees Americans themselves doing. I mean, Americans were organizing the revolution on their own already in Philadelphia, Boston, and elsewhere. And all Paine wanted to do is say, look, let's make this colonial rebellion into a struggle for independence and democracy.
Here's an email that's come in. Are the philosophical underpinnings of the civil disobedience employed by Gandhi and Martin Luther King traceable to Thomas Paine?
Indirectly. Indirectly. Okay. I mean, it's indirectly because Paine actually did have an influence in India. There were various American, oddly enough, American missionaries who one would imagine would not have liked Paine because of his deism, who actually took with them, Unitarians and others, who took with them to India Paine's writings. So it's not unlikely that there might have been that kind of influence. By the way, I'm reaching a bit here, I have to confess. Okay. Now, with Martin Luther King, the black churches in the South, there's not a lot of evidence that Paine was in any way a popular figure in black churches any more than they were in white churches because of the fact that he was a deist. However, it's not unlikely that King himself, in his readings at college and all the more when he came up to Boston, might well have included Thomas Paine. Though it's something of a stretch, okay? It is something of a stretch. I can say this, that there isn't a lot of literary evidence, but it's not unlikely that even at the time of the American Revolution, that those African Americans who could read, whether they were free or slave, would have picked up on the arguments of common sense and Paine's later writings to realize that they too had a place of struggle here in America. And by the way, there's a letter that Paine wrote in 1790 when he's in France after the American Revolution. And he writes back to, it's either the mayor of Philadelphia at the time or Benjamin Rush, the doctor, and he's lamenting the question of slavery. He's worried about slavery as a problem in America, and he actually suggests that northern free blacks who are educated be sent into the South. This is really fascinating to think about, to stir up black slaves.
Oh.
I mean, that was, by the way, you can imagine how slave owners hated Thomas Paine.
Right, right.
Oh, God.
Yeah, let's go to Art from Milwaukee. Hi, Art.
Hi, great show. Just want to add a few thoughts and ask some for commentary about Tom Paine's influence on the German immigrants who settled Wisconsin.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm president of Milwaukee Turners. The Turners, we don't exactly have a patron saint. I think we're the oldest civic organization in Milwaukee, but Tom Paine would be the closest thing to our patron saint. There's a picture of Tom Paine hanging in the room where we have the 4th Street Forums.
Hmm.
Kathleen, I don't know if you know that there was at least one, I think there were maybe more than one, towns in Wisconsin named Painesville, named after Tom Paine, in southern part of Milwaukee, what's probably maybe now Oak Creek, Franklin area, was one of the Painesvilles.
Ah.
We have in old German script, a whole series of books from Tom Paine's, a couple of volumes of his Politische Werke, but there's also a couple, I have no idea what's inside of them, on his Theologische Werke, his theological works, whatever those were, I don't know. He had quite an influence, and I'd also be interested in hearing a little more about his role in the French Revolution before the hour is up.
Okay. Thank you, Art, so much for your call.
Kathleen, that was Art, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think I know Art. Maybe we've met, but I have to say that I'm so glad he called in because, first of all, I love the fact that having grown up in the East, that I came to Wisconsin these 30 years now, and of all the states in the United States outside of the places where you think of Thomas Paine having lived and everything else, the place where Paine's spirit lived on was here in Wisconsin, and it was decidedly because of the German and German Americans. And I can tell you that here's what the story is on that, which is great. Paine's pamphlet, when it appeared in January of 1776, Common Sense, that is, appears, of course, in Philadelphia. And Philadelphia had a huge German population. And almost in 24 hours, it was translated into German for the sake of the locals who couldn't read English. And copies of the pamphlet were placed on American ships or even European ships that were heading to Germany. And it became a huge success in Germany, in German, Common Sense, and later Rights of Man that Paine wrote during the French Revolution, so that German working people, and especially liberals and progressives, when they thought about America, they thought about it by way of Thomas Paine's Common Sense. And in 1848, when the German and European Central European revolutions take place and have very, you know, they fail essentially, though there were some positive outcomes, many of these German radicals, liberals, and progressives, they come to America carrying Paine's writings in German.
Oh, my.
And where, of course, do they come to? Well, they come to Wisconsin.
Yes.
And Milwaukee becomes the center of Paineite, as well as Chicago and elsewhere. But I think especially Milwaukee becomes the place for Paineite activity. Also, out in Sauk City, Wisconsin, in more rural areas, you've got these free churches that are established that became very much Paineite centers. And to this day, I believe, in Sauk City, Wisconsin, they celebrate on Paine's birthday, the closest Sunday that is to Paine's birthday, a Paine festival. The other place in America where these Germans to become German-American settled is the hill country of Texas.
Oh, my goodness.
And so they have Paine celebrations there for years on end. And to this day, and by the way, I'm one of the founders of the Wisconsin Labor History Society, and we've been around now for about 30 years. Our very first meetings back in 1980, something like that, Well, anyhow, we're held at Turner Hall, and we've gone back a couple of times. And why do we go back? Because that is, of course, one of the homes of the Wisconsin labor movement as well. And I had the pleasure of speaking on Thomas Paine a few years ago at Turner Hall for the Labor History Society. So Wisconsin is a place of Paineite thought. And, of course, John Nichols over in Madison, and who writes for The Nation, is one of these, you know, spirited Paineites as well. I'd have to drop his name.
Right. We take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about Thomas Paine this hour of the program with Professor Harvey K. Rosenberg, Professor of History, Sociology, and Director of the Center for History and Social Change at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He's the author of a couple books on Thomas Paine and many other books as well, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. He's also author of Are We Good Citizens? Thomas Paine, Firebrand of the Revolution, which is a book for young adults. Why Do Ruling Classes Fear History, and other books as well. Art, thank you so much for that great call. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join the conversation in the minutes that we have left. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to more phone calls. Hugh in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. Hi. You know, he wrote a book called The Age of Reason,
right,
which is a strong attack on the Bible, not because it may be wrong historically or not because it may be wrong in other ways, but because it was immoral, that the morality stressed in the Bible was what Paine considered to be immoral in many ways. In fact, some people at the time said the Bible was really written by God, the work of God. And he said if it weren't written by men, it would be written by a monster. So these kind of discussions, and I surely urge everybody to take a look at the book, but surely this would arouse the ire of many of the religious, just like burning the Quran is arousing the fanatics, the fanatical Muslims. Paine, is really an interesting figure. I didn't know his connection with the Germans. The Turners, by the way, the Germans in they had four Fs in Germany. The four Fs, fresh, free, and something else. But also religious, pious. But the Turner Hall and met those who had to come to America, it became frisch, frei, stark, und strong and true. The pious was deleted with the Turners, the left-wing Turners, who had to flee in the 1848s. Paine, I remember, was imprisoned in the French Revolution. The French Revolution, of course, was much more anti-Christian than the American. And the American, you have this establishment of the churches, particularly in the South, But in France, the Cathedral of Notre Dame became the temple to the goddess of reason and so forth. So it was far more radical in the French Revolution. But Paine himself was to suffer.
Okay, Harvey?
Yeah, he raises a lot of good points. It is interesting to note that Paine wrote The Age of Reason, his critique of organized religion and scripture, he said, in defense of God. Paine believed that he needed to defend God. Now, this seems curious, right? But let me explain. Paine was in France, and he was horrified at the idea that the French revolutionaries, the Jacobins, were going to he believed in disestablishing churches. So he favored the idea that the French Revolution would lead to the disestablishment of the Catholic Church. But he was then horrified at the prospect, and which then he witnessed, of Robespierre and his crew setting up their own church, this church, to reason. And so he figured it was time to defend God. So he writes an attack on anyone who would pretend to be able to speak for God and to set up a church to impose a religion upon others. And what Paine said is that God revealed himself in the creation. He was, in some ways, Paine was actually a creationist. He believed that if you really wanted to understand God, you needed to understand the creation. Now, he didn't mean merely in a spiritual sense. He meant in a scientific sense. He said if you really want to understand God's thought, you might say, then study nature. Make sense of the world. The more we know about the world, the more we will not only be able to do something in it, the more we will, in essence, be able to understand God's intention.
Hmm.
So it was, in essence, it was an argument in favor of reason and science, what was then called natural philosophy. But in his mind, he was defending God against others who would have reduced God to a set of texts that Paine believed were written by men.
Professor Kay, this very, very short article that got us rolling on this topic this hour talks about the Age of Reason and says that this time Paine's words missed the mark in contrast to common sense. He was condemned as an atheist, shunned by friends, and denied citizenship in the United States, the young nation he helped create. Is that true?
Well, okay. It's not true about the citizenship. Let me explain to you that that's an interesting story, a sad but interesting story. After the Revolution, New York State gave Paine a cottage and a small farm in New Rochelle, New York. And it was a farm that had been owned by a Tory who had left the United States during the Revolution. Now, some of the Tories left and some of them stayed, and a lot of the Tories who stayed in the New York area were living in Westchester County in the New Rochelle area. And they were, in essence, they went underground. They hid that. They sort of denied their Toryism. Well, anyhow, when Paine settled up in New Rochelle, he quickly realized that he was not amongst friends, or at least not there. And so when he went to vote, these Huguenots is what they were, these very conservative French Protestants, who felt loyal to the crown because the crown had given them refuge in America from it's a long thing. So what happens is Paine is denied they tell him he can't vote because he's not a citizen. So it isn't the United States that denies him the citizenship. It's the town of New Rochelle. Now, however, in 1945-46, the town of New Rochelle apologizes and issues a statement that Paine was indeed a citizen. And by the way, it's kind of curious because Paine was one of the figures that Americans made a great deal of during the during the struggle against fascism during World War II. So in essence, these leaders of New Rochelle were kind of embarrassed into confessing their ancestors' mistakes. Okay.
Well, that's quite a story. We have a minute to take on a huge question here, but that's all right. We'll do our best. Mark is on the road. Hi, Mark.
Yes, real quickly. I'm curious, given the German influence of Paine's writings, I'm curious to see if Karl Marx, if there's any connection there, if he had what he thought of Paine's writings. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
I really went searching for some kind of evidence. I found none. But it's again, given Marx's early, young writings and his connections to other radicals. It's hard to believe there wasn't some kind of reading, but there's, to my knowledge, and if anyone can show me otherwise, there's no direct reference in Marx to Paine, other than the kind of democratic spirit that Marx's writings also exude.
Hmm. Oh, this has just been a wonderful hour, as was our last conversation with you about Thomas Paine. You can make anybody in the world enthusiastic about
thanks.
This. I love it.
By the way, this is the start of a new semester. The opportunity to talk about Thomas Paine, I hope my students benefit from the fact that you enabled me to become happy and spirited.
I hope you made it required listening, for heaven's sake.
We are. Oh, by the way, one last thing. We have a second. The Door County Democrats are going to begin next summer to have an annual Thomas Paine dinner.
Oh.
And so I recommend to the Turners that they think about doing something like that as well, and I'm happy to help out in any way.
Wonderful. All right. Thank you. Harvey Kay, our guest, Rosenberg Professor of History and Sociology, Director of the Center for History and Social Change at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. He is the author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. And we thank him for the lively hour. He loves Thomas Paine. You can just hear it, can't you? He just loves him. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And thanks for listening, everybody, to the Ideas Network.